Lights.
Camera.
Philosophy.
It's the 2020 Dionysus Awards.
For the most thought-provoking movies of the past year.
And the nominees are...
For the most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America.
What are the criteria for evaluating what's a violation of privacy?
Is privacy a civil right?
I think so.
Maybe the law isn't so sure.
For the most morally stimulating and or morally desensitizing movie of the year.
For Dopest Doctor Documentary.
I don't remember a thing about Rolling Thunder.
Okay.
I mean, it happened so long ago I wasn't even born.
Which movies of the past year challenged your assumptions and made you think about things in new ways?
The 2020 Dionysus Awards.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
If you like Philosophy Talk, you might also enjoy podcasts from our friends at the IAI, the Institute of Art and Ideas. Check them out at iai.tv. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Jeremy Sable.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative, and I teach in Stanford's Program in Structured Liberal Education.
Jeremy teaches philosophy, he's got a background in philosophy, and he's also involved in filmmaking, which is why I'm especially happy to welcome him as a co-host, because today, it's our 7th annual Dionysus Awards show.
The Dionysus Awards are presented each year to some of our favorite, most thought-provoking movies of the past 12 months.
One of which turned out to be a big winner at this year's Oscars. That's Parasite by Bong Joon-ho. Later in the show, we'll ask Jin-hee Che from King's College London whether she thinks it also deserves the Dionysus Award for most morally stimulating and or desensitizing movie of the year.
We'll also consider a pair of nominations for the most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America, as well as a couple of more or less nonfiction films competing for Dopest Doctor Documentary.
And to help us get started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to explore some music-themed movies of the past year. Documentaries, biopics, and more. She files this report.
You don't usually go to the movie theater to see musicians. But if you went to the movies in 2019, you probably heard a lot of music and saw actors playing the best and worst versions of your favorite singers. There was Rocket Man, where Elton John becomes famous, struggles to accept his sexuality, and, spoiler alert, eventually goes to rehab for addiction.
People don't pay to see Reginald Dwight. They pay to see Elton John.
There was Judy, where Judy Garland is already famous, does not go to rehab, and, another spoiler alert, dies shortly after belting out Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Where
this next one, it isn't a song about getting anywhere. It's about walking toward somewhere that you've dreamed of.
These movies all include some fiction to capture the singers' lives, or at least how we want to remember them.
Boy, sure hope we get to Boston on time.
But the film Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story, is on a whole different level.
I married Isis on the fifth day of May.
But when you said married, I assume you meant marriage between two people.
Yeah.
Did you?
Well, I know, mental marriage.
Mental marriage?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The film uses real footage from Dylan's 1975 Rolling Thunder Review tour, but it's filled with made-up stories and people who only pretend they were there. It's a weird film.
First, what I wanted to show was musicians working together, making music together.
A couple of days later, he said, how about if you just come on the road with us?
He's the guy who got me into the Rolling Thunder concert that night. Jimmy Carter.
But some film critics have argued there's no better way to capture the spirit of Bob Dylan than through trickery and games. The movie, I have since learned, is meant to be a kind of riddle, like the 60s, like the singer himself.
Because it's about nothing. It's just something that happened 40 years ago. And that's the truth of it.
Why don't we go down that road?
Okay, we can. Let's go.
Bob Dylan is known for surrounding himself in mystery and obscurity. Bruce Springsteen, though, he tells it like it is. The movie Blinded by the Light is straightforward. It's not about musicians so much as the fans.
So, tell me about the boss.
Bruce, the direct line to all that's true in this world.
The film centers around a Pakistani teenager living in 1980s England who discovers the boss.
It's like Bruce knows everything I've ever felt, everything I've ever wanted. I mean, sometimes I feel so weak, I just want to explode. Explode and tear this whole town apart. Take a knife and cut this pain from my heart.
The film Yesterday is also about fandom, but in reverse.
Hey Jude.
It imagines a world where the Beatles have been totally forgotten. Only one guy remembers them, and he attempts to capitalize on all their songs.
Hey dude, are you sure?
He's right. That's so much better.
Is he? Is it?
Yeah. Hey dude, don't make it fast.
Definitely going to be one of the best songs of the generation.
Hey, wake up,
dude.
Wake up, Joe.
Don't make it bad. Do-do-do-do-do-day.
Musicians can inspire tragic, weird, uplifting, and surreal movies. And many of these films make us think about fame and loneliness, the value of songs, and how we connect with each other. But to be honest, and maybe this was the point, most of these films just made me want to listen to the music instead. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that great report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy, and I'm here with my Stanford colleague, Jeremy Sable. Today, we're thinking about the most philosophical movies of 2019 for our annual Dionysus Awards.
So, one of the movies that Holly mentioned was Martin Scorsese's Rolling Thunder Review, A Bob Dylan Story. Holly said it was a controversial film.
No kidding.
Right, which is why it's a candidate for our Dopest Doctor Documentary Award. The other film in this category is a very different kind of film, which, full disclosure, came out at the very end of 2018. They Shall Not Grow Old by Peter Jackson. This is a film assembled out of old footage from the Imperial War Museum, out of interviews with British servicemen about World War I.
Hey, I think I see where you're going with these, right? These are both documentaries, but they're both tinkered with a little bit, right? In the case of Peter Jackson, he's taken this original footage, but he's colorized it, he slowed it down so that it looks a bit more realistic, as we would say, and added sound, right? You can hear the horses.
That's right.
You can hear the cannons and things like that. And then in the case of Scorsese, well, what's going on there, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, so, Josh, there's a number of elements of the film which are fictionalized, and they don't announce themselves as such. So, for example, there is a filmmaker who is ostensibly responsible for the archival footage of this tour.
Stefan van Dorp.
I wanted to show the land of Pet Rocks and Super Slurpees from 7-Eleven. L'Amérique insolite. I would go on the road with the Rolling Thunder Review.
Right here.
So Scorsese has shot this footage in such a way as to make it seem real.
And artfully added Stefan van Dorp's voice to the archival footage. So it sounds like as they're going backstage up the stairs, he's right there with them talking about what's going to happen next.
Asking Dylan questions, and Dylan is sort of, you know, refusing to answer.
Van Dorp, I wanted to tell you something.
What's he doing?
Well, I'm a little befuddled by Scorsese's choices. We could defend him saying that as Dylan's a fabulist, so is he. And that kind of playful messing with us is certainly something that comes out in the film and is not only coming from Dylan, but Joan Baez, right, who talks about moments not on stage but off stage where she impersonates Dylan and people believe that she's actually Dylan and she's got the hat on and the weird makeup and the mask.
And there was this table of, like, food and catering and coffee, and Louis was there, and I said, Hanson, give me some coffee. And so people got me some coffee like that. And do you want this? Do you want this? Do you want milk? Do you want sugar? And I just had a cigarette in my hand going like that. And they treated me the way they treat Bob.
Do you want this? Do you want that? What can we do? It was amazing.
So that element is present in the film, and Scorsese's own echo of it or mimicking of it doesn't feel necessarily out of place, but I'm not really sure what it adds. I mean, I feel like the fascinating aspect of Dylan, and in this case Joan Baez, doing that kind of stands on its own, and Scorsese's kind of just muddying the water.
Right. There's all these weird omissions. I mean, at the time of this tour, Dylan is filming a fiction film, Renato and Clara, that stars him and his wife, Sarah. He's singing the song, Sarah, pretty much every spot on that tour. But Sarah doesn't make any appearance in this movie. There's no discussion of the greatness of the songs. There's all kinds of things that aren't there. And then on the other hand, there's all this stuff that wasn't happening that just seems to get added for no reason at all and that could risk convincing certain people, ugh, I guess you can't trust anything. How about the other film that you mentioned, They Shall Not Grow Old, that wonderful film by Peter Jackson about World War One? Because, you know, World War One obviously still resonates with us as an important event. But it's so far away in history now that it almost as though it's the Peloponnesian War or something like that. But watching this film, it feels like a thing that happened. In fact, it feels like a thing that's happening.
Machine gun bullets came at us like hailstones.
I didn't realize that. The swish, swish were bullets.
I looked round, and people were dropping all around you. I mean, they just faded away, you know, on either side of you.
And I thought, oh, what were shooting at me for?
Peter Jackson said a lovely thing about this, because, you know, the folks who fought in World War One saw a war in color. They didn't see it in black and white.
Right.
So there's a way in which his tweaking of the footage actually makes it more real as opposed to less real.
Yeah, right. And there, you know, we could imagine a defense of all kinds of imaginative reconstructions, like what's historical fiction about, right? So maybe that's the same kind of impulses. But we're making stuff up, and maybe we should, in this historical moment, on the same principle, be skeptical, be worried about Jackson's directorial impulse to bring this event back to life and give it a particular coherence and an angle. And here, Josh, I'm not only thinking about this masterful kind of technical job that he's done, but also in this kind of weaving together of the visual experience of these very young soldiers with the recordings of the soldiers, the participants in this war, much later on in their lives, looking back retrospectively. So two acts of memory, right? This kind of cultural act of memory by Jackson, but also these individual soldiers looking back on their own experience as we're seeing them as young men on the screen. We're hearing these older men reflect on their experiences, and some of those recollections seem very odd to me.
Well, I can only say one thing. I wouldn't have missed it. It was terrible at times, but I wouldn't have missed it.
Oh, yes. If I could have my time again, I'd go through it all over again because I enjoyed the service life.
And this is an aspect of the film which actually ties it strangely back to one of the other redeemable features of the Scorsese-Dylan project, which is this strange cognitive dissonance between the characters we see in the archival footage, Dylan and Baez principally, and the interviews with them in the contemporary moment that were filmed for Scorsese's film, where we hear them say very different things than the things we're seeing. So there's this kind of conflict between the retrospective voice versus the kind of naive, young, enthusiastic participant in the fray that we see on screen in the footage. But there still remains a big question that we have, which is we have to decide which of these two films, They Shall Not Grow Old and Rolling Thunder Review, is, in fact, for this year, the dopest doctored documentary.
Well, I mean, for me, it's no question. The project of Peter Jackson, that's a coherent project. I think it makes the movie, if anything, more real rather than less real. Whereas on the side of Scorsese, it's not clear what the plan was. And I really do fear that it's just another drop in that big bucket of confusion about what is real and what isn't.
So you're saying that the Dionysus Award for 2020, the dopest doctored documentary, should go to
They Shall Not Grow Old.
No regrets and no horrors. Because if you survive that, you can survive anything.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our 7th annual Dionysus Awards show, honoring the most philosophically compelling movies of 2019.
Coming up, Josh and I will announce winners in the categories of most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America and most morally enthralling and or desensitizing film.
More Dionysus winners, along with nominations from you, our listeners, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I laid on the beach and I looked at the sky when the children were babies and played on the beach.
Welcome back. It's Philosophy Talk's annual Dionysus Awards show. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Jeremy Sable. We're thinking about movies from the past year that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
You know, it's rare that a Dionysus nominee also wins big at the Oscars, but Parasite, directed by Bong Joon-ho, recently won 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. So will it also take the Dionysus Award for most morally stimulating and or desensitizing film of the year?
We're joined now by Jin-hee Che. She's a professor of film studies at King's College London and the author of The South Korean Film Renaissance, Local Hitmakers, Global Provocateurs. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jin-hee.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
So what to you made this film Parasite so interesting and important?
Well, I think Bong is one of the few Korean directors who are working both in the commercial sector and also abroad, like for Snowpiercer and Okja partly. But Parasite is a film that he went back to Korea for the production. And I think he was a little bit more sensitive of the social condition of South Korea through this film. So I think that's one of the fascinating thing about Parasite. But the film was really well received, both critically and by the audience in general. And there's a little bit of like little humors and then kind of dialogues that also attracted many audiences in South Korea. So that was seems to be a little bit more of the economic disparity that seems to appeal to the general audience in South Korea.
Yeah, so that's a question I had when watching the film, because I saw the film and felt both that it was a critique or an exploration of class relations and class conflict in South Korea. But I also immensely enjoyed the film. And I wonder if there's a tension there between its wild success. Can this be a film that is really forcing us to confront economic disparity and class division if it's so wildly popular? Or does its popularity suggest, in fact, that it's more an apology or something to make us feel better about those class conflicts?
Well, I think it could well registers the kind of the concerns of the general public and especially kind of tension between generations about the kind of economic disparity, lack of social mobility. The film registers that kind of despair of the younger generation. I mean, it is a critique, but I think it's kind of registering the social atmosphere rather than reflection, I guess. That's the way I would like to put it.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, there does feel to be a kind of critical edge to it. Mm-hmm. You know, who's the parasite, right? Mm-hmm. Who's the real parasite, right? Is it really poor people who are struggling to get by and might have to cut a few corners? Or is the rich family maybe the real parasite?
Jessica, this is Dong-hee.
안녕하세요.
아, 예. 배송이 잘 좀 부탁드립니다. 수업 끝나신 건가?
네, 방금요.
저 윤기사.
네.
시간 어때요?
아, 괜찮습니다.
그럼 뭐, 쌤 좀 모셔다 드리지 뭐, 어?
But at the same time, I feel like the movie also complexifies things. I mean, you know, the movie begins in this light, comedic, almost picaresque kind of vein, yeah, and gets pretty serious and pretty dark.
Yeah.
And I feel like it kind of destabilizes us morally. What's your feeling about that, Jin-hee?
I think you're right. Like both, I think the rich family and the poor family are parasites, and the another one actually, you know, kind of in the basement. I think all three families are kind of interdependent, and the kind of moral complexity is that like at one point we align with one maybe family and then another, and the kind of the catastrophe at the end makes everything a little bit destabilized, I think. So I agree with you that there's this kind of shift between different families and the relay of characters, but then at the same time what happens to each character kind of somehow makes us rethink about how we felt about the other characters originally. So kind of reposition ourselves in relation to various characters throughout the film.
I think of this film as one of my favorite kinds of genre of films, a film that takes us morally by surprise.
Hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. We thought we knew where we were. We have a very deserving family that we're rooting for, who are unjustly, and this is true, they're unjustly in an inferior social position. There's nothing that legitimates them being in the position that they are. They're resourceful, they're smart, industrious, and so on. So we root for them. And when they kick the housekeeper out, we root for them, and so on and so on. But when bad things start happening, we have to question ourselves. Where did we... Something went wrong in our moral reasoning that led us here.
아빠! 아빠, 아빠! 우리한테 집중 좀 해줘! 응? 우리한테! 용기사 말고 나한테! 제발 좀!
타이밍 죽인다, 응?
Another aspect of the film Parasite, which I think adds a kind of a different tension to the film, and that's the conflict between what we might call economic values and family values. And it seems like, particularly when we think about the Kim father, Ki Taek, he's struggling a little bit with the impulse to survive, but also the impulse to keep his family together.
But I thought it's the mother who actually does that.
Yeah,
like,
okay.
I think among the family members of, like, you know, the, you know, Kim's family, the father is the most inefficient person, right? Even like folding boxes for pizza deliveries and such, is the mother and other families who are more efficient yes. rather than the father figure.
So you see ultimately the characters in this film as still remaining within traditional patriarchal archetypes?
I think he's not critiquing enough. I think he's kind of playing with kind of gender roles throughout his other films. But all the kind of female characters disappear, either, you know, by death, or somehow off screen. And so it becomes, again, father-son relationship. And some of the film scholars working on Korean cinema, it's all about, like, you know, crisis in masculinity. And
right.
it's not just men, but women also struggle in under this kind of economic conditions to have a career and, you know, kind of manage a family and such. But somehow they kind of, like, conveniently disappear.
Jinhee, you said something nice, which is maybe he's, you know, raising up ideas of femininity for critique, but he's not critiquing enough. Would you say that about the film in general, that it's maybe bringing up social issues like economic disparity and class conflict, but maybe not going far enough?
I should say that the reception in this country has been fascinating to me. I don't know what it's been like in Britain, but over here we've had two, you know, among other responses, two very extreme positions, one of which says this movie is just wonderful propaganda. You know, this is a wonderful call to arms. And on the other side, people saying this is a justification of impoverishment, right? Yeah. It presents poor people as deserving to be poor, which I think is weird reading of the movie. So where do you stand on this? You know, are you critical of the film's politics? Are you, do you think it's handling things in a subtle, sophisticated way? Where are you on this?
I think the film acknowledges the problem. I think he kind of like poses a question and then acknowledges it. But I don't think he wants to provide any solution. But I think there's a point of like acknowledging it and somehow dealing with that through commercial conventions. And so I think that might be the strength of like Pung's film, although he can be a little bit more sensitive about gender representation, I would say.
That seems like a very reasonable critique, yes. So what should we do with Parasite by Bong Joon-ho, Jeremy? Should we give it the award for most morally stimulating movie of the year or the award for most morally desensitizing movie of the year? What is this, chloroform or caffeine?
Well, Josh, I got to go with caffeine on this one. I found both watching the film and having this great discussion with Jinhee Che really quite stimulating. And in a non-simplistic, I don't know where to turn on this film, if it's telling us anything or if it's simply giving us questions that we've got to consider more at length.
And so much the better. Listen, I'm totally with Jinhee on the, she put it beautifully about this film constantly keeping us off our balance, constantly keeping us destabilized, making us think, making us talk, as we're doing today. So the 2020 Dionysus Award for the most morally stimulating film of the year goes to
Parasite.
Thank you so much, Jinhee, for joining us today.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk's annual Dionysus Awards, honoring the most philosophically compelling movies of 2019. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Jeremy Sable. Next up, nominees for the most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America.
We're joined now by Matthew Stroll. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Montana, and he also writes about film at his blog, Strolltopia. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hello, happy to be here.
So, Matt, what two films are you nominating for the category of most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America?
Well, the two films are, on the one hand, Loose, which is a film about a young black man who started out his life as a child soldier in Eritrea and has been adopted by white parents and become the high school valedictorian. And the other movie is Give Me Liberty, and it's about a Russian van driver in Milwaukee who is supposed to be getting various clients to work but ends up sidetracked by a mission to get a large group of older Russian immigrants to a funeral.
Give Me Liberty, that's a film that's written by Alice Austin and Kira Machanovsky, and I think it's a really fascinating vision of contemporary America. What's your sense?
You know, I think an interesting film to compare it to is Uncut Gems, right, which also released this last year, where, of course, like you have the Adam Sandler character in that film making a series of bad decisions that snowball into a very chaotic, stressful situation that turns out tragically. And I feel as though this film, Give Me Liberty, is in a way the opposite, right? So it's a film where the central character similarly makes a lot of misguided decisions, right? So there's a running joke in the movie where he's supposed to be getting all of these people to their destinations on time, and he's constantly forecasting 10 minutes tops, right? As he continues to make decisions that make that goal utterly impossible to achieve. So there's a similar sense of escalating anxiety, losing control of the situation. But in this case, his aims are entirely good-hearted, right? He's just trying to do the best he can for everyone around him, get everyone where they need to go. But there's this similar result of escalating anxiety and chaos.
Yeah, I know. I'm on my way. 10 minutes tops.
I'll be right there. But you're 30 minutes late. How much longer?
Yeah, I'm on my way. I'll be there in 10 minutes.
You're screwing us. You know.
Part of what is so appealing about the film is that so many different people get thrown together in the course of the narrative, right? You have this large group of elderly Russians, and then you have a number of younger black people. You have this cantankerous blind man who doesn't understand why everyone's protesting all the time, right? And these people are all sort of thrown together in this chaotic, humorous situation.
Yeah, and what is this togetherness, right? Is this a potential vision, whether positive or negative, of America? You know, because the main character, whose name is Vic, the van driver, he seems, on the one hand, to want to live in a world of rules, you know, where everything's kind of stable and predictable and his day isn't going completely bananas. But on the other hand, there's something kind of attractive about a world of openness and warmth and flexibility and difference and variety.
Well, my sense as I watched it was that the order is coming from outside, right? So it's like, in order to participate in the economy, to have a job, you have to sort of be at a certain place at a certain time. You have to fit into certain structures. And he's trying his best to do that, but he's so good-hearted, right, that he's unable to say no to any sincere request. So these people are like, I need to get to this funeral. You have to get me there. And he can't turn them down, right? And so his good-heartedness, his sort of openness to the needs of his community is in conflict with the order that the economy is imposing on him.
There's this wonderful moment where Vic says, rules are rules.
No, sorry, it's Dima. Dima says.
Dima, who's the boxer.
I'm sorry about your aunt, but I cannot help you. You have to call that manager's office on Monday.
Okay, I understand. Rules. Rules are rules. I understand.
The stress of the film, weirdly, you know, it lodges some of the complexity of the film in the viewer's experience. So we're on the side of Vic making the wrong decision. We want him to stop being so nice, right? We want him to actually get there in 10 minutes. But we should be rooting for his moral instincts. And he keeps making the wrong decision, but we're kind of on the wrong team in a way, wanting the stress to be relieved.
Right. It reminded me of the Farrelly Brothers' Dumb and Dumber, right, where they keep picking up hitchhikers, right? And then everyone ends up singing songs. And of course, there's an echo of that in this movie, right, where all of the Russians in the van start singing, "Let my people go," right? And one of the characters says, "This is a wonderful song. This is a song both for black people and for people like us," right? So the film is set amidst the 2016 Milwaukee protests in response to a police shooting. Right. And most of the characters in the film that aren't black express confusion about why anyone would be protesting. Like, why would anyone be complaining? I don't get it. But by the end of the film, you have the Russian character, the boxer Dima, chanting and joining the protest along with everyone else, right? So there's this sort of very endearingly clumsy portrait of how these barriers are breached simply through contact. Like, just throw all these people in a bus, and by the end, they actually manage to hash out some kind of understanding, however clumsy it is.
So let's turn to Luce, L-U-C-E. This is a film directed by Nigerian director Julius Ona, based on a play by J.C. Lee. Tell us a little bit about what you think the questions are that this film is raising for us, Matt.
What I think is especially interesting about Luce, right? So the film, it was a 2019 film, but it's based on a play that originally debuted, I believe, in 2013 and was written during the Obama era, right? So Luce is, I think, quite clearly supposed to put us in mind of Barack Obama, right? And the Barack Obama character, sort of stand-in character in the movie, is not the hero of the film, right? And indeed, it is a highly problematic character. And so, again, what draws me towards Luce, among the sort of huge roster of topical films about race in America right now, is that it's one of the only recent films that has the courage to be complex, right? To not paint a simplistic, moralistic picture where there's one side is right and one side is wrong.
I love that. There's a moment in the movie where the school teacher, Miss Wilson, says, it's not that simple. And Luce says, nothing ever is.
So it's about what's reasonable.
That's what courts are for.
Really, it's just about people, though, right? Whether they conform to what we think they are.
It's not that simple.
Nothing ever is.
I mean, one thing I love about Luce is that it credits us with intelligence. It credits us with the ability to recognize that a fictional character is flawed, and yet they may be saying things that are true, you know? That the two things, they can come apart, you know? And this is a film that's full of different moral frameworks. It's offering that there's the law, there's morality, which is different from the law. The school teacher points that out. There's violence, right? The Frantz Fanon, amazingly, comes up in this movie, a philosopher who preaches the necessity of revolutionary violence, but also love, right? The school teacher is talking about language, bringing us all together. And then there's a fifth category, which is a kind of family closeness and privileging your nearest and dearest over maybe somebody else. And so it's just a roiling mass of different possibilities, and it gives us the credit to think that maybe we can find our way in that without being preached to.
You know, early on, we have this idea of Mrs. Wilson as being this character that puts people into boxes, and we see her, right, our very first scene of her in the classroom, both kind of dividing the classroom around race lines and putting people into boxes. So we have that view of her. But in fact, she's the only one that actually sees Luce not in terms of categories, but in terms of who he really is. Like, she sees something wrong with him from the very beginning, and that's what condemns her in our eyes, is that she correctly perceives him.
Right. There's a line at the end of the film where she says, it's America that put you in a box, right? And she says something like, it's dirty and it's cramped and it's stinky and very little light gets in.
Why do we have to be perfect to be accepted?
Boy, that's a lie.
No, you're just so desperate for approval that you eat your own alive just to get it.
Whose approval?
Who do you think? Everyone who made you feel like being black wasn't good enough. But I don't need their approval. I'm not going to be somebody's symbol just to make them feel better.
You still don't get it. You don't get it.
And she sees her own role as the bearer of that harsh truth. So when she's dividing people up into boxes, she's not the one doing it. She's just letting them know they're in that box whether they like it or not. And I take it that one of the themes of the film is that it's looking at the idea that, you know, deep down, do we feel like there's some taint to coming from a place like where Luce comes from? And that's our deepest anxiety, is that all the middle class upbringing in the world can't cleanse the taint of whatever we imagine Luce's upbringing has shaped him to be.
Okay, Jeremy, so we've got Luce by Nigerian director Julius Ona, and we've got Give Me Liberty by Alice Austin and Kirill Michanowski. Which of these two films wins this year for most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America?
Gosh, Josh, this conversation was stimulating, and now this vote is stressful. I think my vote goes to Luce. It's an incredibly stressful movie. Stressful even to talk about afterwards.
I agree, but also amazing movie to watch. You won't just be stressed. You'll think hard and you'll be moved. So, the Dionysus Award for the most stimulating and stressful vision of today's America in 2019 goes to Luce. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're taking a philosophical look at the movies of 2019 for our 7th annual Dionysus Awards.
In our next segment, we'll take nominations from listeners around the country for their favorite thought-provoking movies of the past year.
Suggestions from the floor and so much more when Philosophy Talk continues. It's the 7th Annual Dionysus Awards. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Jeremy Sable, and we're talking about the most philosophically compelling movies of 2019. It's time for nominations from our community of thinkers. Michaela in Tallahassee, Florida, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Michaela, you've got a nomination for us.
That's right. So my nomination is Mati Diop's Atlantique from 2019, from this year.
Atlantique, which in English, I believe they translated it as Atlantics.
Yes, it's a little bit confusing because she also has a short film from 2009 called Atlantique with an S. One thing that's so captivating and moving about this film is that it's about the anguish and peril of migration in Senegal. But there's this really important turning point in about the midpoint of the film where it takes a supernatural turn.
And suddenly becomes a ghost story.
Exactly. And so the men who have gone out to sea come back and actually haunt the women that they've left behind. And in one case, Suleiman, the love interest, he haunts the detective who's looking for him, as it were. And so it's really moving because you get these scenes where the two lovers are brought back together, but the Ada, she's like looking at her love interest, but in the wrong body.
I'm a fan of ghost stories and stories of possession, so I don't need convincing why you should make movies like this. But you could imagine a film going through similar material and working over themes like this without recourse to the supernatural. Is it important that this film use that genre, or what role does that fill in the film?
So one is that the boys, they actually get to come back and tell their story, which is something that you can't do without having recourse to this level of fantasy. So you get the story of like their last minutes of life, which is heartbreaking. And so part of the plot is that they're actually construction workers and they were not paid their last 4 months' wages or something like that. And so they're working on this really futuristic looking building in Dakar. And then at the very end, Therese, one of the female characters who's now like possessed by the spirit of one of the boys who left, she's telling the story of seeing this huge wave come and collapse on top of the boat. And she says, it collapsed like a building, like the boat collapsed like a building. So you get these sort of impossible stories like told from the mouths of the person who lived them, but it's the consciousness of that person, not necessarily that body.
I mean, it's such an interesting device, isn't it? I mean, it reminds me a little bit of magic realism. You think of someone like Isabel Allende or Gabriel Garcia Marquez or even Toni Morrison, where you have these novels that are profoundly enmeshed in painful realities of injustice and oppression, but that also include supernatural elements. And, you know, you might worry, well, is this blunting the edge of the critique? But it doesn't seem to feel that way. You know, it feels like it sharpens the edge and maybe even does another thing, perhaps, which is to gently nudge our neurons a little bit and make us more receptive to different kinds of future possibilities.
Yeah, and I mean, one really interesting thing that Mati Diop has said in an interview is the experience of showing this film actually in Senegal and like the different audience reactions to it in terms of like the ontological difference between seeing like your lover return and seeing the spirit of your lover return. And so she pitched this as really a gothic film that was deep, that it's fantasy, but it came from a deep need to make a reality speak to different populations or speak to Europe in a way that would make them feel for refugees, make them feel for migrants. But she said that when she showed this film in Senegal and she asked audiences about it for the first time, they said, oh, this isn't a fantasy film. This is our reality, like living with death, living with departure, living with exile. Like this is a reality, but on the level of the haunting as well.
I'm thinking that Atlantique or Atlantics by Mati Diop should be nominated for a Dionysus Award of the best ghost story about the real world.
Michaela, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's get another nomination from the floor. Tom in Northampton, Massachusetts. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So, you've got a movie you'd like to nominate?
I do. A Hidden Life.
This is a historical drama written and directed by Terrence Malick.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting film. It takes place in Austria, right as the Anschluss, the Nazis, taking over power. And the main character, whose name I don't remember, is a farmer. And he lives in this rural town. And he's basically, he's not an anti-Nazi, but he refuses to do anything to sort of show his allegiance to them. So he won't give the Hitler salute and say Sieg Heil. Even more significantly, when he is drafted, which turns out he won't sign a loyalty pledge to Hitler, which all the recruits were required to do. And what happens eventually is that he gets imprisoned. And what the reason I think it's so interesting philosophically is that you really get to see someone who stands up for his beliefs no matter what the consequences are. And, you know, Malick's a very interesting philosophical filmmaker in general because he was actually a philosophy graduate student, and he wound up translating one of Heidegger's books. He's the guy who translated it.
I know there are traces of Heidegger in The Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
Do you see any traces of Heidegger in A Hidden Life?
I think there's the sort of notion of being true to yourself and being authentic. I guess there's a sort of they society, the people sort of trying to make him do something socially acceptable so that he won't have to endure the punishment that he endures. But you can sort of see the voice of the they. I mean, I think it's pretty strong there.
So it's Heidegger's philosophy working against Heidegger's own life commitments and choices, right? If you're a real Heideggerian, maybe you don't sign up with the Nazi party.
I think it's more nuanced. I mean, in part, it's because his family suffers because of the persecution by the townspeople, and they're made to feel horrible. And so you can see how, even if he feels like he's doing what he has to do to himself, there's a real pull because he has to see what the effects are on his wife and child. And his wife is actually very supportive, and she keeps saying to him that whatever you do, I'm with you. It's up to you.
Whatever you do. Whatever comes.
So it sounds like the movie is asking a couple of questions in the domain of moral theory, one of which is it legitimate for me to decide for others? So let's say I decide that the right thing to do is to stand up to the Nazis. Well, I'm nonetheless choosing a future for my family as well. So to what extent do I have the right to that? And another question is, what about will in all this? Where does my motivation come from? There's a French thinker, I forget who, maybe Jeremy will remember, who says, you know, we have all of the good maxims in the world. The only thing that's lacking is the will to put them into action. We're not short of principles.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what you see in this film is how difficult it is. That it really shows you all the ways in which this guy feels incredible pressure from everybody that he comes into contact with to basically conform. I think Malick's idea is that religious faith is the thing that allows you to maintain your own personal integrity in the face of all these pressures.
So, Jeremy, I'm tempted to nominate A Hidden Life for most morally sophisticated film about resistance to conformity.
Well, that's much better. My category is going to be Best Heideggerian Film, which opposes Heidegger. But, Tom, you decide which one the film receives.
I like the latter one.
Okay.
Excellent. Yay. I do, too. Tom, thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Let's hear from another listener, Miriam in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm enchanted.
So, we hear there's a film you'd like to nominate for a Dionysus Award.
Absolutely. Pedro Almodovar's movie, his latest one, which is called Pain and Glory. This boy and his mother, they're very close, but the level of communication is very poor. There's a lot of love, but there's also a lot of pain because of the misunderstanding. And the misunderstanding goes to a level where each party in this relationship makes a lot of presumptions and a lot of assumptions, and therefore their own perception on what the other person is thinking or judging or saying in their mind. And it basically translates into somewhat of a epigenetic pain for the boy. And as he grows up, he internalizes all this pain, and it becomes grossly more than psychosomatic. It becomes very physical and eventually ends up with opiate addiction. So it impacts his work. It impacts his relationship. And the mother and son have a lot of misunderstanding towards the end of the mother's life. And eventually the son, he goes through a lot of pain, and then he loses the mother.
So at this point, I feel like Almodovar could have called this film just Pain. Can you tell us a little bit about the glory?
The glory part is that Almodovar, this is his own autofiction, as they call that in Spanish, autoficción. So the autoficción is about him in a fictitious screenplay, but it's about him. So the glory comes to the point where he finally releases the pain by finding a voice in one of the actors that defied him initially in a couple of his plays and did not do justice to his work and abandoned the play. He finds this actor, and the actor also is going through a lot of personal pain. And the actor takes one of his final works and acts it out on a monologue on stage, and it's a huge success.
Después intenté salvar a Marcelo y salvarme yo. Si Marcelo se salvó, fue lejos de mí. En cuanto a mí, yo me quedé en Madrid. Y el cine me salvó.
So, this actor not only took his work and voiced it out for him, he also provided him with the opiate to numb his pain. So on two levels, for him, it was glory because he could release the pain and he would find recognition again amongst his audience.
So it sounds like Pain and Glory raises quite a number of philosophical questions. Among other things, how much access can we have to the inner states of other people? Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot of obstruction there. There's a lot of confusion, assumptions being made that aren't right. Sounds like there's a question there about whether the truth is always the thing we want, because this film, after all, is autobiographical, but it's an autobiographical fiction. Mm-hmm. And maybe the fictional part is a good version of the opiates. Don't take opiates. write an autofiction instead, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But a third thought I have, and this is one I really want to run by you, is inspired by the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche, who might have looked at this and said, Yeah, that's the way to go about it. If you've had a painful childhood or anything painful in your earlier life, see if you can't find a way to redeem it by turning it into something positive. Is that a reasonable way of thinking about pain and glory, that it's the story of someone who redeems a childhood of suffering by turning it into art that would not have been possible without that suffering?
Absolutely. As a child, Almodovar was able to give so much to a person who was illiterate, and then at the same time, he was able to redeem himself later in life, finding that this person that Almodovar educated was in fact a brilliant artist. So as a child, he gave something. He was trusted by an individual who learned so much from him. And then later in life, Almodovar doubted his trust with his own mother, but then found his trust in his audience, in this artist, and also in himself.
Jeremy, I want to nominate Pain and Glory by Almodovar for Best Fictional Autobiography that Raises Questions About Other Minds and the Redemption of Suffering. What do you say?
I got to agree with that, Josh. I'd say yes.
Mariam, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
If you've got a Dionysus-worthy movie from 2019 that wasn't discussed on today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send your suggestions to comments at philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantwan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. And Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or mis-expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Jeremy Sable. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.